And I'm McKenna.
And together we're the Daily Profcast.
We're two long-distance besties
who share a love of Harry Potter.
We hope you enjoyed the episode. Welcome back to the Daily Profcast.
Your source for all things nerdy and Harry Potter.
Erin, do you want to give us a rundown of the happenings of the week?
First of all, we need to say a really big thank you because in the last week, our podcast listenership has grown. And we're very thankful for that. A contributing factor to that has been I started a TikTok account. I was really reluctant to start a TikTok since I've known about TikTok. And I did it for this podcast. And I've just been making dumb, silly videos and having a blast doing it. And we got a big following on that. If you're from TikTok, hey, welcome. Really glad you're here. Thanks for listening. And so that's been fun. Daily Profcast has an official TikTok account.
Yeah, Erin makes the funniest Harry Potter sketch videos, and they're so silly and lighthearted, but it's amazing. As soon as one of those videos took off and then she mentioned the podcast on TikTok, then overnight we just exponentially grew in terms of listenership and how many plays our episodes are getting and the retention. It's honestly pretty freaking incredible.
Thank you everybody for listening. Kind of, do you want to give us the stats?
Yeah, definitely. I mean, Erin and I, we've said this a lot before on the podcast, but we really did this for us.
Yeah.
I think of it as like the ode to our friendship. But this is just 14 years of friendship culminated into like us just getting to sit down for 3 hours and talk to each other about something we love. So it's pretty amazing to see that go somewhere at all. And we felt like we were doing pretty well with listenership, especially for a really small. We were just talking about how we can make our mics better, and I have a piece of paper surrounding my mic. We're pretty janky little setup here.
It's not very high tech over at the Daily Profcast
yet. But basically, as soon as the TikTok videos started going, then we started getting an incredible amount of listeners. I just want to give a little shout out to some of the countries we have people listening from, because I can't even believe people in America want to listen to us talk. It's even more weird to think that people outside of America are even interested in us. So we have a lot of people in the UK who are listening. So hello to you, friends. Ireland, Germany, Australia, Canada, France, Gibraltar.
Whoa!
Netherlands, New Zealand, Norway, Sweden, Malta, Denmark, Italy, Switzerland, Poland, Hungary, Argentina, Belgium, Brazil, Cyprus, Iceland, Austria, Portugal, and Syria.
Oh my gosh! Thank you, everybody. We're really pleased to make your acquaintance.
I hadn't showed Erin that list, so her face was
I'm freaking out right now.
Really?
Thank you, everyone who's outside of the U.S.
Yeah, it's pretty incredible. There's no national well-done rankings of podcasts because there's so many different listening platforms. We're available on Spotify, Apple, Google, Overcast, Stitcher. The list goes on. But Apple Podcasts is a pretty great metric to see how your podcast is doing. And anybody who's in the top 200 makes it onto the iTunes webpage and on your podcast app. And so purely by all of our friends and family, plus all of our new friends from TikTok and Instagram, we have gone from basically obsolete to, I woke up and I texted Erin. I said, you have to call me as soon as you wake up because we have a 3-hour time difference. And she called me right away. And just 2 days ago, we were 169 in the arts category for the US charts. And today we just looked and we're number 70. Out of thousands and thousands of podcasts and in books, we're top 20 right now, basically. So
that's crazy.
It's crazy.
I can't believe people, we're doing this because we just like analyzing Harry Potter. I can't believe people want to listen to us analyze Harry Potter.
Erin and I basically just wanted to argue about Snape, Sirius, and Lupin for 20 hours straight. Yeah.
Yeah.
We're not just in the top charts in the US, we're in the top charts of Germany, Poland, the UK, like Sweden. It's pretty crazy. So thank you guys so much. We just couldn't appreciate you more.
Correct. Oh my gosh. Thank you. So with that, should we get into our chapters for this week?
Yeah, absolutely. So again, thanks for listening. And if you're new here, we have a whole basically season on the Sorcerer's Stone. So if you're interested in that, always there for you to go back and listen. But if you're a longtime Harry Potter fan, you can basically jump in anywhere because we're just covering things you already know. But if you're new and you're just rereading the series, like, it's great to go back, I think, and start this process with us again.
Yeah.
And today we're going to be covering chapters 6 through 11.
Chamber of Secrets.
Of Chamber of Secrets.
Start us off, McKenna. Where are we?
Chapter 6 is all about Gilderoy Lockhart.
Oh, boy.
Oh, boy.
Gilderoy
is right.
Lockhart. I said this in the last episode, but if you thought Kenneth Branagh, first of all, he did an amazing job as Lockhart, but if you thought his Lockhart was annoying and you've never read the books and you just have this desire to be so annoyed, read the book, because Lockhart in the book is so annoying, so irksome.
He's actually the worst.
The cool thing about going on in this series, just starting off in Sorcerer's Stone, the cool thing is we get more information about how Hogwarts works and mm-hmm. how it functions. We get a little bit more information about that in here. We find out they have double classes. So they'll say like, oh, I have double potions with the Slytherins or whatever. Is that like a block class?
I always believed it was just a longer period.
Yeah.
Maybe a lab day.
Where yeah.
You're going to be doing an extra long project. And so you need extra time to be getting that done.
Yeah, exactly. Oh, and then here's my other question.
Yeah.
Does anybody know of like a detailed layout of Hogwarts Castle and all the classrooms? Does anybody know if that exists? Because I'd be very interested to see that.
Yeah, I would be interested to see if there's anything canon, because I'm sure a lot of fans, and I've seen a lot yeah. of like fan art come out with the map basically, but yeah, I don't know if I've ever seen anything specifically canon.
I believe wizardingworld.com has like a virtual tour. I don't know how detailed it is.
Oh, the author has put one out?
Probably. Anyway, I would love like a big giant, people have like the maps of Middle Earth. Like I saw somebody on TikTok. I don't know if this person's listening. I saw somebody on TikTok with a wall in their house that is like the map of Middle Earth.
That's
like,
amazing.
I want that with the Hogwarts Castle layout. First thing that happens basically is Errol flies in with the iconic.
Do you think you could do the voice for us?
Weasley! How dare you steal that car? I am absolutely disgusted. Your father has an inquiry at the ministry. I don't remember the rest of it. Inquiry at the ministry, something. We will bring you straight.
In the movie, it's like one of the parts of the movie that does the book so much justice.
Oh, yeah.
It's fabulous.
Totally. So good.
So they get the howler. And it's when I was rereading this, I felt so sad for Harry because he feels like he really messed up. And the Weasleys have been so kind to him. It's just amazing to see the way that Harry's decisions like mean something to him. He realizes the weight of his decisions, because I don't really think children are always like that.
Absolutely.
Sort of a special quality of Harry.
Yeah, and it's a theme that Mrs. Weasley is really hard on Ron, obviously. By kid 6, you're just a disciplinarian. And she's never that really disciplinary with Harry, because Harry's not her biological
child.
But yeah, but I mean, he kind of is, but he isn't. She has this sort of softer spot for Harry. I think there may be a part of Harry where the guilt comes from the fact that he knows he should be receiving this sort of reprimanding too, but his parents aren't there to do it.
So. Yeah, he's never had true parental discipline. The Dursleys were cruel.
The funny part about this is after Ron gets scolded by the howler, suddenly Hermione, who was cold and upset with them for breaking the rules, feels like he's gotten the punishment he deserves, and now she's like okay with it. Hermione is definitely the mom friend.
She's an Enneagram one. That's who
yeah.
we are.
So you guys are the mom friends. I can attest to that. Then we meet Professor Sprout, a squat woman, a queen, really.
Queen.
A plant mom to the extreme. We meet Professor Sprout and they're about to go to Herbology. She's strolling over. I don't want to make this too much recap, but she's walking over with Lockhart after having faced off with the Whomping Willow to repair it.
I know, they say they put the Whomping Willow in slings, which I think is great.
Whomping Willow is one of my favorite characters. But so she's walking over and Lockhart, of course, is like, oh, if only you'd called me over. I know just the thing to subdue a Whomping Willow because he's annoying. And here's a question that a lot of people have asked over time, and I don't know if it's ever really been answered. Dumbledore is obviously a really smart man, right? So you would think he would be able to see right through Gilderoy Lockhart. You don't think Dumbledore's going along with this guy. So if he knows that he's a total fraud, did he literally just hire him to expose him as a fraud? Because that seems like a far way to go to embarrass somebody.
Yeah, you know what? That's a really good question. And I think it opens the door to a larger conversation. How much does Dumbledore know? And what is his plan? I always feel like Dumbledore is the puppet master. He's controlling the simulation.
Totally.
Obviously, in this book is when, spoiler, so if you really have not read ahead, maybe skip 15 seconds or so, but Harry is going to destroy a Horcrux in this book, though we're not even going to understand what that means until book 6. Spoiler over. Thank you. I always assumed Dumbledore started piecing that part of the story together after this, after he has his hands on the book. And he's trying to figure out what dark magic this is. But then it always makes me wonder, okay, why did he pick Quirrell as a Defense Against Dark Arts teacher? Then why did he fill the position with Gilderoy Lockhart? He was obviously terrible, not a good wizard. I don't know. It's just so intriguing to think, what did Dumbledore know? And why was he making the decisions he was making? Do you think maybe Dumbledore put Lockhart in to teach Harry the dangers of fame? Like what happens when it gets to your head?
Oh my gosh, I love that analysis. That's brilliant, McKenna. That still seems like a really far way to go to have your students.
Okay, but it's Dumbledore.
It's also Dumbledore, and like, it's Dumbledore. So
literally, like less than a year ago, we were letting children go through the Forbidden Forest with the Dark Lord on the loose. So
it's Dumbledore. They're dealing with the mandrakes, an iconic scene we get in the films. I should point out in the films, it kind of looks like all of the second years are there in the book. They're just there with the Hufflepuffs. So unfortunately, according to book canon, Draco Malfoy does not get his finger bitten by a mandrake, although we love that visual. Well, here's another thing we find out about Hogwarts that's like another Hogwarts tidbit we get. There is a lunch bell.
Yes.
There's a bell system. What?
I had the same reaction. Could you imagine, like in a traditional high school, those high school 80s movies, there's always the kind of nerdy kid who runs the intercom in the morning. Could you imagine Lee?
Stop.
Is the intercom boy in the Saved by the Bell version of
good morning, gals and ghouls. Welcome to another fine day at Hogwarts School of Witchcraft and Wizardry.
It's McGonagall, like Lee Jordan.
Standing over his shoulder. Oh my gosh, I can't. That's my new favorite headcanon. Go ahead.
I was going to say, it was my first thought when I heard the bell ring, and I was like, what bell?
I mean, it doesn't have to be like an automated bell. It could literally be like a bewitched church bell.
Yeah, and this was it could be automated through magic.
Oh, that too. So another person we meet in this chapter is Colin. Colin is all of us if we like encountered Daniel Radcliffe in real life. So I know he's supposed to be annoying, but I understand.
Yeah, it helps that he's younger. He's like a little boy.
Yeah, it's like cute. Not to Harry, but to us.
We get some important information with the mandrakes. Professor Sprout tells us it's essential to many antidotes. Thank you. And I don't know, this is just what's so good about Harry Potter, is they just drop that in, and then you don't realize it's important for like 10 more chapters.
Or 10 years, and then you go back and reread, and you're like, oh! Yeah.
So, the mandrakes, it just so happens, Dumbledore's going to say it later in the book. Luckily, Professor Sprout was able to get her hands on, like, a crop of mandrakes this year, and has been potting them. So what they're doing is taking the babies and potting them into bigger plants for them to grow. And they release this horrific scream.
Deadly scream.
Deadly scream. Exactly. But when they're babies, they're not deadly. When they're babies, it's just annoying.
Yeah.
Annoying in the way that you would faint if you heard it. Without.
Ron is having issues with his wand. And then they go to Defense Against the Dark Arts.
Very important first day
of school test.
This makes me so mad, this part.
This just makes me uncomfy.
It is uncomfy. It's cringy.
It's icky. I don't like it.
So Gilderoy Lockhart, the new Defense Against the Dark Arts teacher, as we know, hands out a quiz that is all about him. What's his favorite color? What is his life's aspiration? Nothing to do with class material. What would you do if a teacher did this to you in real life? If you got to your sophomore lit class and a teacher handed out a questionnaire about themselves.
And it's very clear that it's not a joke.
Yeah.
Oh, I think I would walk out.
A fun tidbit, Dumbledore is part of the Order of Merlin. So is Gilderoy Lockhart, based on what everybody thinks he does. He's third class, Dumbledore is first class, and you get an Order of Merlin honor bestowed on you. I would liken it to a Nobel Peace Prize for the Wizarding World. You get the honor bestowed on you for contributions to the Wizarding World. I also want to say, Lockhart is able to be so manipulative because he's charming and conventionally attractive. Can we address that?
Yes. This is what makes me really uncomfy about Lockhart too, is that it's not just grown women. Like, we see that Mrs. Weasley is obviously attracted to him.
Hermione?
Yes, but then it's children.
Yeah.
And this is what makes me grossed out, because this is like, I don't know, he's probably...
He's 28, so he's a pretty young teacher, actually. But, you know, according to his books, he's very accomplished.
I think that he is able to manipulate because of his looks and how people perceive him. And when it's adult women, I'm like, okay, we could be smarter women. Let's rise against this conventional attractiveness idea of this golden-haired man who's most definitely a moron. But when it's children, it's just so icky and manipulative. Yeah. That these like 13-year-old girls are, I don't know, they're like tricked into thinking they're getting a quality education from this man because he's beautiful.
Because he's beautiful, exactly. There is an element of cringiness to it. And Hermione, and what's so funny is like Hermione is the brightest witch of their year. And even she is fooled because, and gives him that allowance because she finds him attractive. All of his spells are like really funny. They're just like, they're really silly. That's what I'm
saying. Like even the like excerpts of the book we get, it's quite obvious he is not a good wizard. You know what I mean? He doesn't have any sort of substance.
Chapter 7, Mudbloods and Murmurs. Yes. Can we go over the Quidditch stuff? Oliver Wood, who is a minor character that I absolutely love because he's just so dedicated. He just, Quidditch is his great love and it's beautiful to see. He gets the team up this year super early. They have to go rehearse super early. He's like, we're going to rehearse harder and stronger and more than any of the other school teams. And he's just like a big, sweet jock and I love him. What's nice is there's no changeover in the Gryffindor Quidditch team from last year. So they're practicing with all the same players, which is advantageous. When they get to the Quidditch pitch, the Slytherin team is there. And they're like, what are you doing here? We have this book for practice. The Slytherin team hands them a special permissions note from Professor Snape saying, we're training our new seeker. And they go, who's your new seeker? Draco Malfoy's their new seeker. And surprise, Daddy bought the entire team new Nimbus 2001s, which is a very good, very expensive broom.
Yeah, and call back to the beginning of the book when Harry ended up in Bergen & Bork's and overheard the conversation where Draco was complaining about Harry being on the Quidditch team and being a seeker and being everybody's favorite. And at the time, Lucius said, basically, get over yourself, you know, if you want to be good, be better and stop talking crap about Harry Potter. And then fast forward, Draco has gotten what he wants. Typical spoiled child. He's essentially bought his way onto the Quidditch team.
Correct. Hermione says, at least no one on the Gryffindor team had to buy their way in, said Hermione sharply. They got in on pure talent. The smug look on Malfoy's face flickered. No one asks you your opinion, you filthy little mudblood, he spat. So we learned this term mudblood for the first time. McKenna, would you care to explain the term?
Yeah, oh, it breaks my heart. Yeah, a mudblood is somebody who was a witch or a wizard, but not from a wizarding family. So they have muggle parents, muggle family, probably grew up muggle, and then they're like came into their powers and is a witch or a wizard. It's a slur. It's a horrible word in the wizarding community.
This is the first book where we start getting into the sort of blood status prejudice in the wizarding world. And it's clear that the author draws inspiration for this prejudice from like Nazi era eugenics. And it's a direct parallel to that, which makes it really scary. Really scary when I sit down with myself and think of what might have happened if Voldemort had succeeded and taken over the wizarding world, and like what he was doing when he was in charge of the ministry.
Yeah,
terrifying.
We learn and we know Voldemort was killing muggles. Being magic is something like you're born with it or you're not born with it. It's like something you have. And to try and invalidate that for somebody because of who their parents are, it's horrible. It's horrible.
It's also like genetically invalid in the wizarding world because squibs are a thing.
Exactly.
But like, status has absolutely nothing to do with your talent level as a wizard, as evidenced by Hermione Granger, as evidenced by Argus Filch. The fact that squibs exist, that is something that can occur, that two wizarding parents can have a child that has no magical ability, is a testament to the fact that your blood status does not correlate with your ability.
You can tell by the way Ron reacts that even though he comes from a family that's as pure blood as it gets, he knows it's wrong. And this is important, and it's important for us now as we're rereading this in 2020 as adults to realize that these kind of values, racism, in this case, blood status discrimination, is taught in the home. It's parents and communities. Likely, yeah. The Malfoys are very proud of their blood status, and they likely hang out with a bunch of people of similar blood status, all who believe that they are somehow superior because they don't have these like muggle influences in their genetic trees. Then you go to a school, and this is where I have an issue with sorting, because if you're getting sorted into the same house as all of your family has been sorted into, it's a less chance of like a diverse spectrum of ideas and beliefs and influences.
Yeah, that's true.
Draco grew up like this in his home, and then he goes to Hogwarts and he sits in the Slytherin common room, which I'm a Slytherin, so I can say not all Slytherins are bad, but he goes with a bunch of other friends who tolerate these kind of beliefs, support him, and believe the same. And then their head of house is, unfortunately, like, I love the complexity of Snape as a character, but he's not probably necessarily dispelling all of these ideas as well. I think he was ashamed of his muggle half of his parentage. It's just unfortunate. And we can draw a direct link to 2020 because these kind of horrible ideas, they're bred in the home and reinforced in the community. And
there are characters we perceive to be good characters who still have microaggressions about this. Mm-hmm. Slughorn in mm-hmm. Half-Blood Prince is talking to Harry and he's like, it's really remarkable that your mother was so talented considering she was muggle-born. And Harry shoots back and he goes, my best friend is the top of our class and she's muggle-born. And Slughorn gets really defensive. He goes, no, please don't think I'm prejudiced. That's a microaggression. So it's introduced in other, it's just this sort of ingrained way of thinking is introduced in other characters throughout the rest of the series. So I think it's going to be really interesting going forward to keep tracking that as well, because we can all be guilty of that. We should mention, just interesting that the person who wrote the books and wrote this into the books is now just totally
literally so transphobic.
Messing it up. Yeah, messing it up. Anyway.
Yep.
Okay, going on. So what I think is really sweet is the entirety of the Gryffindor Quidditch team decides to fight for Hermione. I think it's sad to admit that most of us would hear this and just stand there and be like, oh, rather than being like, put him up! But they start fighting for Hermione's honor. And the trio get kicked off the Quidditch pitch. Ron tries to hex Malfoy, really important. Ron tries to hex Malfoy, his wand's broken, the spell backfires, he starts vomiting slugs. So the trio goes to Hagrid's hut.
Sweet man, Hagrid.
We love Hagrid in this house. I can't believe Harry didn't name one of his kids after Hagrid. At Full-Time Nugget on TikTok had this great rant about Hagrid where he's like, I think Harry should have named his daughter Ruby after Ruby is Hagrid, and I'm super on board with that. They go to Hagrid. We get our question from chapter 6 answered, where we're like, why did Dumbledore hire Lockhart? And Hagrid mentions there was nobody else up for the job, really. Also, people think the position is cursed, which it is.
Yeah.
That's like a rumor, but that's actually like true about the position. We'll find out about that later. But yeah, so apparently Lockhart was the only person for the job.
The more now I'm thinking about it, the more I'm thinking, why would Dumbledore choose to put Lockhart in the second year? At the end of the first book, we've just learned that basically Voldemort's back. Voldemort disintegrates into dust and his dust particles flee the scene. But read between the lines, that's not going to be the last encounter we have with Voldemort. I think Dumbledore knows that. And I think Harry, the crux of who he is, also knows that. As Dumbledore keeps using Harry as a pawn to fight off Dumbledore, to fight off Voldemort, Harry's just going to gain in fame, right? As he continues to have these encounters with the Dark Lord. And so maybe putting Lockhart in early on to basically be like, this is what happens when fame goes totally wrong.
That's actually really brilliant. And also, Voldemort is what happens when, in a way, fame goes totally wrong. Because Voldemort's core desire for why he like wanted to become this Dark Lord was because he came from nothing and his main motivation was status.
Yeah.
He wanted to be somebody. Imagine if Harry had gone that way. And Harry has a big struggle with that in this book, realizing that him and Voldemort are pretty similar.
That is going to be a theme for a long time.
So while they're at Hagrid's, Hermione doesn't know what this word means. And why would she? I don't know that you would know. Harry doesn't know what it means either. I don't know that you would know what this word is unless you've come from a wizarding family.
Right.
So Ron is the one to explain it to her. And it's really sad, but it's also kind of sweet to see how Ron thinks of this term. He's not just like, yeah, it's a bad word, but get over it. He's like, no, this is really bad. And it's bad that people call other people this and it shouldn't happen. He's really angry at the injustice of it, which I think is very sweet. Yeah.
The next chapter is a fabulous chapter and they really missed it in the movies. We're going to do a whole episode on the Ghost of Hogwarts. So I think we could get more into that, this chapter and that series especially. But basically, Sir Nicholas, he still cannot be part of the Headless Hunt. And he's trying to gain some favor points. But Sir Nick invites Harry to his Death Day party.
Death Day party. And then on the way back from the Death Day party, Harry hears this voice for the first time. And to him, it's saying, rip, tear, kill, so hungry for so long, kill, time to kill. And he hears this voice and he freaks out. It was the same voice, the same cold, murderous voice he had heard in Lockhart's office. So they're on their way back from the Death Day party and Harry hears the basilisk voice again. And he runs off and Ron and Hermione run after him. And they find this writing on the wall that says, the Chamber of Secrets has been opened, enemies of the air, beware. And of course, just in time, everybody from the school shows up and sees Harry like looking at this sign as if poor Harry needed that. Wrong place, wrong time. Does Professor Snape say that in the book too? Because he says that in the movie and I was like, are you serious?
Yeah, he does say that in the book. He says Filch is basically calling that Harry gets expelled and is insinuating that Harry is, along with the writing, Mrs. Norris is hanging.
Oh yeah, poor Mrs. Norris. She didn't deserve that.
Important fact. Yeah. And Filch is freaking out. Filch thinks Harry did it. He wants him expelled. Lockhart's like, oh, too bad I wasn't here because I know.
Of course.
So it would have helped. And then they all go to Lockhart's office and Dumbledore is like poking Mrs. Norris with his wand. Like
examining her. The way Filch cares about Mrs. Norris is really kind of sweet. He doesn't have anybody else in the world.
Dumbledore basically says, Mrs. Norris is not dead. Mrs. Norris is petrified. Luckily, Professor Sprout is brewing some, you know, she has mandrakes, so she can start working on an antidote for this. That Harry has done this because he's a squib. And as they are leaving, Dumbledore dismisses them. Harry is like, Ron, what's a squib? And Ron tells him, you know, a squib is someone born into a wizarding family but hasn't gotten any magic powers, kind of the opposite of a muggle-born wizard, but squibs are quite unusual. If Filch is trying to learn magic from a quick spell course, I reckon he must be a squib. It would explain a lot, like why he hates students so much. He's bitter. Sad.
Yeah.
Poor, lonely Argus Filch.
We also learned that Ginny is inconsolable about poor Mrs. Norris, and it's because
quote, she's a cat lover.
Me?
I mean, you. But also, there's a little bit more to that than we think there is.
Yes, there's a lot more for that to come.
Also,
kind of a funny thing that I loved in this chapter is Professor Binns is assigned a 3-foot long composition of measuring.
Say that! That's another fun Hogwarts tidbit. They measure paper length.
It's hilarious.
We should also note that Hogwarts is not, the Wizarding World is not on the metric system. You ever notice that? They say inches and not. Yards. Yeah, they're not on the metric system.
Professor Binns, which I wish we had Professor Binns in the movie. I think it's a big missed opportunity there for a totally. Good character. But basically, in History of Magic class, they get Professor Binns to talk about the Chamber of Secrets. Professor Binns says, you all know, of course, that Hogwarts was founded over 1,000 years ago. The precise date is uncertain. By the 4 greatest witches and wizards of the age. The 4 schoolhouses are named after them. Godric Gryffindor, Helga Hufflepuff, Rowena Ravenclaw, and Salazar Slytherin. They built this castle together, far from prying muggle eyes, for it was an age when magic was feared by common people, and witches and wizards suffered much persecution. We go on to learn that the founders worked in harmony together, seeking out youngsters. I love the thought that Professor Binns would use the word youngsters.
I love that too.
They were seeking out youngsters who showed signs of magic and bringing them to the castle to be educated. But then disagreement sprang up between them. A rift began to grow between Slytherin and the others. Slytherin wished to be more selective about the students admitted to Hogwarts.
So, I mean, listen, I hate how all Slytherins are portrayed as being evil people. There's some good stuff to you. And I think this is a reason why is it's literally built into the fabric of the foundation of the house, which maybe was a bad thing on the part of the author and like contributes to the fact that all Slytherins are portrayed as being bad.
We get important context here to learn that Hogwarts was founded at a time where witches and wizards were going through intense persecution. So we know from things like the Salem witch trials and like medieval recountings of when people were thought to be witch, how they would be like stoned and thrown to the bottom of the river to see if they would like sink or float. The historical context here is that they had to found Hogwarts in the middle of the Scottish Highlands so that they could basically be able to live in peace and have a resurgence of the wizarding community, like a safety place.
Back at that time when witches and wizards were being like actively persecuted, like taking a child who was born to 2 muggle parents with the religious implications of the time, that's a liability.
Yeah.
But not the child's fault.
Right.
So, and we know, you know, if those magical abilities go unaddressed, we know what happens to a child based on Fantastic
Beasts. Exactly. So I just think the historical context is important to understand that these people were basically trying to find a way out of persecution. They start up their sanctuary, I would say, somewhere that's safe where they could be themselves and practice magic and learn and teach and do all these wonderful things. And then they get to the decision point of, well, are we going to share the sanctuary that we've created with the people who have oppressed us? It's really easy to look at somebody like Salazar Slytherin and be like, well, he was evil and hated muggle-born witches and wizards, and like this is a really like easy black and white situation.
Yeah,
but I just think there's a lot more gray in there to say like I think it's not right, but maybe logical that somebody would be fearful of opening themselves up again. It's not right, but there is a reason that in a non-logical, like an emotional way, could make sense to somebody.
Yeah, absolutely, I agree with that.
And it's important that Godric Gryffindor and Helga Hufflepuff and Rowena Ravenclaw were like, no, we can do this. Like, we can totally take the risk and open ourselves back up. And every magical student should deserve an education and be able to come here and lean into their powers. Like,
it's good. Yeah, and I think you're right. I think it is important to point out that it wasn't like an unfounded fear. It wasn't like a baseless fear. It was a liability to be taking from muggle families at this time.
Again, we can draw parallels to this to our world today But when you let these kind of fears eat at you and take over who you are as a person, that you just, it then breeds hate, which then breeds things like racism, xenophobia, and things like that. We're wired to believe what's different than us is inherently dangerous. So when you already have a mental basis that like, oh, this thing could be dangerous potentially, and you let your brain and your heart run with that and eclipse the logical side of your brain, and then over generations and generations, like that's what continues to be produced. I think it's important that the author wrote some historical basis to say, hey, like relationships between muggles and wizards weren't awesome before this.
Yeah, totally. Off topic, but going on. After hearing this, the trio's like, well, I wonder if there's a way we could sort of, you know, if the heir of Slytherin is back, I wonder if there's a way we could find out who it is. And they hatch this plan to brew up the polyjuice potion. And they're going to do it in Myrtle's bathroom.
And to get the polyjuice potion, it takes a month. And a lot of the things can be found. We learn there's like a student's warehouse of potion supplies that they can go to. But then Professor Snape also has private stores of probably like more dangerous or rare
potions. Not to be like carelessly handled by students.
It's going to take a month to brew the potion. We will return back to this later. And then it's time for Quidditch. And they are going to be playing My House Team with their new seeker, Draco Malfoy.
So the sort of, there's always, I feel like we never see Harry have like a normal Quidditch match.
No.
We never Harry. Even like even in book one where he has the one where he catches the snitch in like 5 minutes or whatever, like we don't even get to see him do anything because it's written from the perspective of Ron and Hermione in the stands.
Harry, would be difficult to write Quidditch.
That's true. Like, there's a bludger that has been sort of tampered with and is constantly going after Harry. And it gets him too. It hits him in the elbow and breaks his arm.
Yeah, that has to hurt.
Oh yeah. Can you imagine? Like, I want to know like the miles per hour force.
My leg, and I believe that it is as painful as that.
So Harry gets his arm broken by the bludger.
Yes.
And Lockhart comes to the rescue. Baracchio and Mendel. And Harry no longer has bones in his arm. I love the visual in the movie where he like bends his wrist back.
Yeah, gross. It's pretty gross. So too bogged in the plot. But basically, he goes to Madame Pomfrey's. She's like, why did you not come to me immediately? Like, why did you let that idiot get rid of your bones? And then she has to take Skellagrow.
And tell us about
Skellagrow is a Potter invention. Not James Potter, but James Potter's great-grandfather.
Yeah, invented Skellagrow.
That's how the Potters originally made their fortune.
Dobby comes to check on him. Also learned that Dobby fixed the bludger to try and get Harry to go home.
And closed the portal.
That's right. We also learned that he closed the portal to the barrier to platform 9 3/4.
So would you say that Dobby is chaotic good?
Dobby is 100% chaotic good. The motivations are so good, but so chaotic. Something really important gets confirmed for us. Dobby confirms that the Chamber of Secrets is A, real, and B, has been opened before.
Yeah.
And then at the end of
the self.
Yeah, I would trust Dobby with my life.
With my life.
And then at the end of the chapter, there's a student this time who gets petrified, not just Mrs. Norris. Now a student has been petrified, and it's Colin Creevy.
Yeah.
Oh, poor Colin.
Colin Creevy has his camera, his like classic camera that he's always walking around taking pictures of things, specifically mostly Harry. And I think it's McGonagall says like, oh, can we look and see, maybe he got a picture of his attacker. And when they open the back of the camera, it's just like steam that comes out. This assailant can evade photo taking, have learned.
I'm going to start referring to the antagonist in every book of the series as the assailant. I love the visual of the basilisk with like a little Zorro mask. Chapter 11, The Dueling Club.
Can you take this one from here?
We start the polyjuice process in this chapter, and we also learn that Draco Malfoy is staying for Christmas. And I'm wondering, why is Draco Malfoy staying for Christmas? What they could be dealing with is the raid, the ministry raid on their house. They could be dealing with that right now.
Is there an official raid on the home? Do we get that? Do we know that?
We know that Ron told his dad about the secret chamber under the dining room where they keep some stuff. I don't know if there's an official raid on the home. I don't know if that's written in here. I don't remember,
actually. Because all the old Death Eaters could be, you know, getting back together, trying to figure out what's happening.
That's, yeah, actually a really good question is, when do they start organizing again?
Anyway, so Draco's not going home.
Yeah, Draco's not going home for Christmas. The other thing is they have to figure out a way how to steal from Professor Snape, who's pretty much telepathic. And so Harry sets off a firework in class to distract him while Hermione runs to his personal store and grabs some stuff out of it for the potion. And it works, but at the end of that class, Harry's like, he knows it was me. There's something in the way he was looking at me, he knows it was me. So just another thing where Snape's kind of a psychic.
He is a psychic.
I don't know if he is a Legitimate or if he's just skilled in occlumency.
Yeah, I guess skilled in occlumency is probably.
I think we need to like look at the differences between that when we get to maybe book five. And then we have the dueling club.
Oh.
Here's my question for you, McKenna. What do you think is the equivalent of dueling club at Muggle school? Like, it's not the chess team.
Okay. I think I have this.
All right.
I have two examples here for you. I have in high school, my high school had a fencing club.
Okay.
That feels equivalent. And then in college, I was part of a air rifle team.
I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wait, yes, I did. I forgot.
I didn't do it for very long because I had to like wake up at 4 a.m. to go do PT for ROTC, and then practice was 6 a.m. and then class was 7 a.m. So gross. I wasn't really feeling that vibe.
Yeah.
But I think those are equivalent clubs/teams.
Yeah. So we have the dueling club. This is an idea. This is Lockhart's idea to start this dueling club, which is ironic because Lockhart does not know the first thing about defensive or combat magic for that matter.
But you know who does? Who we learn who does? Sev.
Sevy. Sevy Snape.
Snivellus.
Snivellus Snape. There's literally a quote. I have a quote in here on page 189. Lockhart says Professor Snape knows a tiny little bit about dueling. Snape was, first of all, created combat spells because of how he was tormented during his Hogwarts years. And second of all, was a Death Eater. Pretty sure you had to engage in some combat to be a Death Eater.
Literally, so all Snape would have to do is release, like, one, the Secum Sumptra curse on him.
Yeah. Done for. Bye, Lockhart.
He's bye-bye.
In the film, we just see them bring up Draco and Harry to, like, do a little demonstration duel. In the book, they pair everybody up who comes to this dueling club. So everybody gets to put in a pair, and everybody gets to start trying, which results in chaos because then everybody just starts hexing each other. And I just think it's hilarious the spells that they teach the kids at this level, because they're like tickling charms and Tarantallegra, which is like a dance that makes your opponent start dancing. It's not like anything useful. Chaos abounds, and they're like, maybe we should just pick two people to do this. That's when they end up picking Draco and Harry. Snape says something really mean to Neville because Snape is mean. Are you gonna fight me on that?
No, Snape is mean to the kids. I can recognize that.
McKenna, you're the smartest Snape fan, because I know why you're a Snape fan, but you recognize that he's not a perfect person.
No, it's because he's not perfect that makes me like him.
Draco and Harry pair up, and Draco conjures this snake, and it starts going towards Justin Finch Fletchley, and Harry starts telling, we read from Harry's perspective, he's telling the snake to leave Justin alone. And to the reader, we're just hearing Harry say, like, leave him alone. And then they get rid of the snake. And then later, Ron and Hermione are like, you're a parcel mouth. And Harry's like, what are you talking about? And this is the first time we learned that Harry can speak parcel tongue, which is, and it's not the first time we've seen him do it. Because the first time we saw him do it was book one.
With book one. Yeah.
But we didn't know that was what he was doing.
Exactly.
We just thought, oh, he can talk to snakes.
We can assume a couple days ago, Professor Binns has told the class that basically, like, Slytherins are evil. Salazar Slytherin, he broke off, whatever. And Harry, it says in one of these chapters, Harry's embarrassed and he doesn't want to tell his friends that he was almost put into Slytherin house. Like, he hasn't let anybody know that. And then now he just finds out he can speak to snakes. And this is apparently, like, an heir of Slytherin trait.
Yeah. Yeah, and not only is he having an identity crisis, the school is buzzing about it after this. They were buzzing about it after the Chamber of Secrets writing on the wall. And now it's even worse now that he's had this incident with Justin, who is a Muggle-born.
Yeah.
So people are like, oh, no. Like, and then it's even worse when Harry is the first one on the scene to find Justin petrified along with Sir Nicholas. And McGonagall literally seemingly catches him in the act. Well, at first Filch does, and then and Filch is very happy about that because he thinks Harry's going to go down because he thinks he's responsible for Mrs. Norris. But then McGonagall finds him, and he just is always in the wrong place at the wrong time. And that pretty much concludes chapter 11.
So the next episode will be us finishing up the book. We always do like a one-off fun kind of episode. So our next fun episode, we're going to be having a conversation with a Bible scholar. Her name is Erin Hicks Moon. And we are going to be discussing all about Christianity in Harry Potter. Basically, like, how do you reconcile your faith with books that deal with some maybe sensitive topics like what we're currently reading. Even if you're not a Christian, we just think that you would enjoy this episode and get something out of it. I don't know, it's just going to be a thoughtful, intellectual conversation, and Erin Moon is just, she's really a delight of a human being, so.
We're really excited to have her on.
Anyway, that's it.
Have a great rest of your day, everybody.
Thanks for listening to our latest episode. As always, please subscribe on whatever podcast platform you're listening on. And if you're not a listener on Apple Podcasts, it would still help us out a lot if you head over to Apple Podcasts and leave us a 5-star review. If you have any questions, comments, concerns about anything you heard in this episode today, please drop us a line at our Anchor profile. You can leave us a nifty little voice message there, or you can head to our Instagram at the Daily Profcast to DM us or leave us an email.